LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Mary Swingle, who joins us to discuss her book, iMinds: How Cell Phones, Computers, Gaming, and Social Media Are Changing Our Brains, Our Behaviour, and the Evolution of Our Species. We live in a high-tech age, an era in which almost every aspect of our daily lives is mediated by some form of technology. The worlds of work, education, leisure, food, transport, health, communication, and many, many more are now not only augmented and enhanced by technology, increasingly, they are impossible without it. But while some of the unwanted side effects of technology are recognized and well known, are we too quick to dismiss them as a temporary phase affecting a lonely minority? The advocates of 21st century technology themselves are quick to point to an array of benefits, many undeniable, but at what point does our second life take over our real life? Social media become antisocial. In our headlong rush towards techno-utopia, are we inadvertently breeding a generation of alienated, dysfunctional loners, paralyzed by endless choice, and lost in a fantasy world of gaming, pornography, and all manner of virtual reality? Delving into the dark side of this brave new world, we examine the dangers of technological addiction and abuse, the debilitating psychological and physical fallout, and the potential to affect even the evolutionary future of the human race itself. Hello and welcome, Mary, and thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Pleasure to be with you.
Mary, today we're going to be talking about your new book. It's entitled iMinds: How Cell Phones, Computers, Gaming, and Social Media Are Changing Our Brains, Our Behaviour, and the Evolution of Our Species. That's quite a mouthful of a title, and deservedly so. There's a lot to chew on there. Before we dive into that, just tell listeners a little bit about your background and your work in general, and then just bring it round to how you became to be concerned with technology, the development of it, and where it's taking us.
Okay. Well, I come from a strong, I'd say, blended background of education and psychology. If you can, would like to know about the nice letters behind my name, I'm MA in education and then MA and PhD in clinical psychology. So you can kind of see, I guess, where these worlds would mesh in terms of the influence of screen-based technology, or what I call in the book iTechnology, kind of converge with education and psych. But where I first noticed things was, probably a good 10 years ago, working out of our clinic here in Vancouver, Canada, that there was a certain group of clients that previously we had had amazing success with, and not just to chest bound too much, but we have a good track record with really being able to help clients. And there was this group of clients that just, quote unquote, was not getting better. So these were children with educational difficulties, people with certain type of anxiety disorders, insomnia, marital conflict and discord, and something was amiss. And then, the epiphany, the bell went off that there was a connection with excessive use of screen-based technologies. I happened to be getting my PhD at that time and was looking for a dissertation topic, and it just seemed a no-brainer to look at this very, very formally. The good news is I was sitting on over 20 years of clinical data So I'm really blessed to have what we call the pre, not necessarily the pre-post, but the pre-during. So really seeing from a clinical perspective over time what the technologies are doing to the brain. Unique opportunity to do some amazing research. And then, of course, after a dissertation, I just had pounds and pounds of paper with all kinds of excessive information that didn't make it into my dissertation. And it was time to write a book.
Now, you hinted there at a generational divide, and I think that you and I are more or less the same generation. And we often see today, when we consider the pros and cons of modern technology, we see that generational divide writ large, with tensions sometimes between parents and their kids. You know, the kids are doing a lot of gaming, or they're always on social media. And the cliche was always that, you know, parents were kind of a little bit alienated by this. And, oh, you know, in my day, we used to cycle here. We used to have to pick up a telephone and do this, that, and the other thing. A landline. That's beginning to change, of course. But overall, we can say that there is a generational divide there. Perhaps you can characterize how the situation is a little bit more complex than I'm portraying it. But when you're dealing with younger people versus older people, that you're seeing different, how can I put it, pathologies, different side effects. And I think a good pair of terms that you use in the book is the digital natives versus digital immigrants.
Yeah. Oh boy. We can go on about this one for a while. When I present, I always say that we're chasing a moving object here. And I'd say when I first really started doing a lot of presentations on this around 5 years ago, I think there are around three slides that are the same in the presentations. It's really, really changing. To help with, you know, classify a bit, digital immigrant versus digital native. Digital immigrant is my generation and older, who were not born into the technology. We literally migrated into it. And the way we migrate into it has been very, very different. There are the great resistors, just the way when people move to or immigrate to a new country, they can resist the language, they can resist the culture, they can resist the food, you know, what have you, the dress, and others just embrace the new culture, and merge it with their experience. Digital natives don't have any of those issues. Essentially, they're born into it. But interestingly enough, we now have different generations of digital natives. So a lot of the divides of, I would say, poor digital immigrants versus digital natives, we're kind of now seeing with individuals who are choosing to limit the amount of rule that screens have on their life versus those that don't. So I'm going to give you another, you know, coinage that I have, which is integration versus interference. So for all of us, technology, I mean, it's fabulous that you know, we're talking overseas over Skype. We don't have our little pictures up, but we easily could be. The technology is magnificent if it's used as the tool it was designed to be. But it can cross over to the negative very, very quickly. And that's where the issues arise. And I think this is where we have to be wise about and open our eyes in terms of the negatives. So the negatives are when it changes our communication style. The negatives are when it changes our base emotionality, when it changes our physiological state. So when we talk about anxiety or we talk about insomnia. Again, pick any avenue that you want to go down there, because I can talk rather endlessly. What do you think your audience would be most interested in hearing about?
Well, one of the things that I get most interested in, because it overlaps with a lot of other areas that I deal with, is basic socialization. And this does pertain mostly to digital natives, probably of whatever generation. And that is to say, for example, people of our age, we've had our own technological, you know, revolutions to deal with in our own time, but we're looking at something, you know, a situation now where things are accelerating and they're a whole order of magnitude greater, they're global, etc., etc. So the socialization issues, that is the how people relate to their own family, how they make friends, how they relate to wider society, just how they become, you know, functional members of the human race, you know, how they have a life beyond themselves. For me, I'm interested mostly from the point of view of digital natives, because I look around me, and not being a parent myself, I see a lot of gathering dysfunction in lots of different areas with younger people. And I've done a few shows about modern technology, and I'm always at pains to stress that we don't want to try and talk in cliches here. You've pointed out this technology is not all bad, far from it. It, in many ways, is quite neutral. It's how we use it. And I'm not wanting to characterize a lot of younger people who I'm, you know, old enough to be their father as somehow all headed down the same path of, you know, dread and doom because of overuse of technology. But perhaps you could speak to the problems, the real, actual, profound problems you do see with how younger people are socializing or failing to socialize because of their relationship with some of this communication technology.
Okay. Well, let me just start with some of the first things that we noticed way, way back when, so at the turn of the century. The first thing that was overtly noticed is that people's behavior altered when we communicated via screens. Some of the more extreme behaviors were coined the disinhibition effect. And that's essentially where we explore aspects of our personalities or act differently due to what we perceive as the protection of the screen. Now, this can be a lot of fun, you know, such as in Second Life. I don't think that game is as popular as it used to be, but, you know, people would essentially invent these personas and have all kinds of fun, you know, play cross-gender and what have you. Then there was the whole cybersex community, and that again is where the term came out of, where people permitted themselves to explore aspects of sexuality that they never would in real life. And because the rules of engagement on screens were different, people acted differently, and arguably people had a lot of fun. You know, nothing wrong with sexual exploration, unless, again, it's perceived as cheating by mates and spouses and things like this. We can also talk about trolling. People, again, they get their own highs on simply just acting nasty and waiting for the reaction. So there's that whole element of exploring altered aspects of ourselves. There's also the alter ego. If you look at the type of, you know, the whole selfie component where everybody just posts the best pictures of themselves, and it's a form of narcissism. Some of the more, I'd say, critical elements, though, have to deal with what I call changing developmental progress or altering developmental phases. Adolescence is a really key example. And, you know, we're talking about how we share the same generation. My generation and older, we discovered the technology essentially in our mid-20s. For individuals that really discover the technology pre-adolescence, they don't go through those awkward phases of adolescence that all of us are designed to go through. So it's when our behaviors change from childlike to adult-like. We become interested in others romantically, and a lot of the awkwardness that comes with that. And arguably, it's critical to go through that stage of life with a significant amount of what I refer to as face-to-face and heart-to-heart. What we find is if adolescents, when they're awkward, go through the screens, that they do not develop the ability to communicate without a digital mediator. And that completely and totally changes development. And what we find is that individuals that have used screens or screen-based devices only as digital mediators, they're compromised in their face-to-face and heart-to-heart relationships. I can go back into newer generations, and this is where we're talking about everybody being a digital native. So parents now are also digital natives. And let me backtrack a bit. There's a story, a clinical vignette I'd like to share maybe before I get into that one, which was I was working with a mother and a child. And the mother was coming in and complaining about how her daughter was always on screens and not participating in the family and just really going on and on. And you could just see the anger swelling up in this young adolescent female. And she turned to her mother and nice explicative and essentially said, "What the F do you expect me to be doing, Mom? You're on your screen all the time too." So that was the first hint that, wait a minute, we're accusing the quote-unquote younger generation of behaviors that we're very, very guilty of ourselves. Don't forget all kids mimic as well. So if you have, you know, a little four-year-old and, you know, dad's on his phone all the time, well, the little kid is going to pick up a chocolate bar and act like, you know, he's on his phone as well, imitating daddy. The catch is it's now a cell phone for the little child as well. So many components going on here. But the critical thing is when children are very, very young, and if parents are on screens too much, or if children are introduced to what I call iPad in the cradle or screens in the cradle, they're not, the children aren't being looked at, they're not being sung to, they're not being tickled, they're not being cooed at. And essentially all of this interaction, whether it's through voice prosody, the sing-song, or the touch, this is all the wiring. Essentially it sets up the neurology for all future communication and emotional systems of the child. So what we're starting to see in children that are exposed to technologies too early, and conversely to parents that ignore their children because they're mesmerized by the technology, is we're seeing autistic-like characteristics in children that do not have autism.
Yeah, there's a few issues there that spring to mind. I mean, sitting a toddler down in front of a television is something I think that goes back probably to the dawn of television, really. You know, yeah. I'm not quite sure what parents might have done before that. Maybe just a toy, anything at all, just to keep the child occupied while the mother or father does something else that they just got to do. But that definitely, as you say, has taken on a different dimension in the electronic age. And I mean, 20 years ago, friends of mine who had just had kids would certainly stick on it. And I can remember them saying, "Oh, I'll put on this video because it lasts for 3 hours, not this one because it's only 90 minutes." You know, and, and the kids seemed quite happy, you know, sort of gurgling away in front of the screen. But the point is, it's like giving your kids sweets or something. It's okay once in a while. You know, but if it becomes the go-to thing, and that's how actually how they're learning a lot of the time, then you can be into sort of a whole world of different problems. And you'll remember when you were a kid, I'm sure there was educational TV. I grew up watching Sesame Street, and one of the reasons why it was okay to watch a program of such marathon length is because we were learning to count and getting all sorts of other concepts coming at us through the comedy of the Muppets, etc., if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say the literature produced by non-vested interests, so I can't emphasize that enough. You have to read the small print of who's doing the studies. So non-vested interest, meaning it's not by the gaming community, it's not by the producers or the sellers of these products. The literature on that is absolutely black and white, that little children are mesmerized by screens, but they learn absolutely nothing, or it's reversed. And I'll do the shameless plug for my book. It's all in there, just in terms of the type of the studies. If you read the small print of the research, the Baby Einstein series is classic, that children learned 6 to 8 words less per hour of when they were viewing versus not viewing. I mean, it's pretty, pretty strong stuff. In the days of Sesame Street and the like, if you look at children's program of different generations, if you look a lot of the children's programs now, there's nothing in it for the parents, if that makes any sense. If you look at Sesame Street was a classic, parents were kind of giggling too. It was almost like there were two scripts going on. The other thing is parents would, like if you, you know, you're counting with the count, the parents would sing that song with the children afterwards. So they weren't just always plopping the child in front of the screen and then doing other things. I'm not saying that didn't happen before, but there was more reinforcement after. And this is what we see today in screens. If you want to play games with your children, please do. They're a heck of a lot of fun, but if you want your children to learn anything from it, debrief. Okay, talk about what you did, if this is relevant or not, so that the learning from the program itself appears to be very, very limited. But if you are socially engaged after or before applying learning from screens, it does seem to have some benefit.
We're just talking about adolescence again, because as you say, what an important phase, what an essential, vital phase that is in our lives. There's a few things to draw out there that that you deal with in the book. A few consequences, I suppose, of this excess exposure to and use of technology. You know, having so many experiences, particularly, you know, relationships mediated through technology. Some of the consequences are that of not learning limits, which is kind of interesting in itself. Because the culture we live in at the minute is one of excess regulation. You know, there are threats everywhere. There's a paedophile under every bush, and there's a terrorist, you know, behind every hedge. You know, and it's kind of that environment. So, but teenagers not learning limits or what danger actually is, and that kind of serious consequences when they do find themselves out in the world, and also not taking responsibility. In an era of excess regulation. And then this other bizarre phenomenon, which I see a lot of actually, is that teenagers in particular can be incredibly busy with technology. Mm-hmm. You know, so constantly occupied. They must be doing this. They're always on their phones or whatever it happens to be, to the point of walking into busy traffic or walking off, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But equally, they'll say that they're bored. They're almost like terminally bored. And that's very, very strange in itself.
Yeah. Oh boy, you've covered so many things. I'm going to start with the concept of danger. When children are playing on screens, they don't learn boundaries. It's as simple as that. They don't learn physical boundaries. They don't learn emotional boundaries. Also, because with screens, you always have the redo. If you're character gets killed in a shooting game, well, you know, you just you get born again, so to speak. If you take the car off the track, you scratch it up, well, it doesn't matter. And many of us found out years ago that it was more fun to crash the car on the circuit than it was to actually, you know, drive it around the circuit. So when kids are only exposed to virtual environments and they go out into real environments, they don't know the limitations of their bodies. So they actually become more of a danger to themselves. So if you look at kids that are climbing, you know, trees from, you know, the age that they can walk, you know, they're hugging the tree and then they're going up a few steps and things like that. By their time they're jumping off of things, they know to bend their knees when they jump, okay, so that they don't hurt themselves. They jump from, you know, half a meter, then they jump from a meter. It's progressive, but the body is also learning the limitations. Again, that's not happening with screens. Same thing emotionally. If you're, you know, playing with, you know, a little bit of bad behavior with your friends, you're going to see the hurt in other people's eyes, and you're going to respond to it. You're going to respond to it as an ugly person, meaning you're going to enjoy the hurt, or you're going to respond to it with empathy. And again, all children experiment with this type of emotional learning. On screens, the fact that we can't see the reaction of the other people, or that we do see it through a screen, it filters too much. There's a beautiful study done with, it was either grade or, I think it was grade 5 students in the North American system, where they took, essentially divided up a class, and half of the class they asked to just continue with screens the way you usually do. So it wasn't extremely controlled. They weren't saying use your screens 3 hours a day or 5 hours a day or what have you, but just use your screens regularly. And the other group, they took out to a nature camp, and all screens were forbidden. And of course, they did a lot of interactive activities with each other. What they found when they tested the two groups when they returned was that the children who had been part of the interactive play with no screen exposure for only 3 days had a substantially higher ability to recognize facial cues. So essentially, they could read emotions on the faces of other people, whereas the children who had just had what we refer to as standard screen exposure had reduced abilities to read facial cues. You don't have to be a major scientist to figure out what that is doing. So I'm not even talking about the bullying and what have you, in terms of, you know, that high that we get with the giving of pain. So that's essentially the response to the danger and the lack of learning of responsibility and the facial, cues, recognizing the emotional, expressions of people. Busyness in iTech. We talk about boredom. If we're looking at adolescence, there's a kind of a perceived need to be busy, a perceived need to feel important. If you have, you know, two adolescents sitting on one side communicating with each other and the other one sitting on another side of a room by themselves, we perceive the person by themselves not doing anything as not so that something wrong with them, but not fitting in with the group or what have you. So screens are an automatic in that type of situation where you just pull out a screen, you're important, you're doing something. The secondary component, apart from the emotional protection or what a lot of people perceive as a vulnerability when they're not with screens, is that when we've been socialized on screens for every single moment, we do not have any clue whatsoever how to self-entertain. We don't know what to do with ourselves. Also, most of our screen based interactions, we're functioning at a higher level of arousal. Okay, so it feels good when we're on them. So when we're off of them, we're not only bored, we're agitated. So you can see the emotional buildup here. It's serving many, many purposes. The third one, and I think as you know, a practicing clinician, you know, with a strong background in education, this is the one that concerns me the most. Is you need blank spots to think. You need blank spots to watch things, to notice things, to integrate information, to assimilate information. And if we don't have blank spots, essentially if we don't feel a little bit of boredom, we are not going to experience curiosity, and we're not going to experience observation. And that is the basis of the acquisition of knowledge that's not trivia. So essentially the acquisition of knowledge that over time and more witnessing and experience in the world turns into wisdom. And I'm very, very concerned about many, many people just becoming extremely knowledgeable on what I refer to as trivia as opposed to integrated knowledge.
I'm just going to throw something in to the pattern of what I'm talking about here, simply because it came to mind and I saw this the other day, and it was on social media. How shall I call it? It was on a popular social media site, let's just put it that way. Mm-hmm. And it was a little meme going around And I can't remember if it was $1 million or $10 million. It was a life-changing amount of money, and essentially proposed the question: would you go? I'm paraphrasing now, but you know, would you stay in an isolated shack in the middle of the woods, in the middle of nowhere, with no telephone, no television, no computer, no internet, no social media, no phone, just everything that you could, we've been talking about and more. None of that. For, I can't quite remember what it was, let's say for the sake of argument, for a month in exchange for this life-changing amount of money. And I remember sort of looking at it and thinking, well, yeah, of course I would. What are you, crazy? Well, you want me to go on holiday and just give me millions? Yeah, I'll do that. But then I thought, well, why is this such a challenge to so many people? And then, of course, I immediately thought, well, yeah, for some people, this is going to be hell on earth. You know, this is going to be, for some people, this is going to be going cold turkey off heroin or something, the equivalent of that, yeah. You know?
Yeah. Very, very, I'm giggling here behind my mic, and the concept of a month, okay? Make it 8 years or something where, you know, something would change. But you're hitting on, regardless of the length of time and the precision of the amount of money, you have it. Many of us now, essentially, it is an addiction. We cannot function without the constant stimulation of the screen, period. And, you know, some of the individuals that I work with, it's just like a heroin addiction. There's the behavioral component of the addiction, and there's also the what we call the substance that, you know, you are getting zapped with many highs. There's no other way to put it. The other is socialization. One of the big reasons that there's such a high recidivism rate in all chemical or substance dependencies is that the social group is there. It's really, really easy for a fellow to stop drinking, but can he not go to the pub because that's where all his buddies are? Okay, so it's the exact same issue with screens. So I'm not sure. I know Europe is much more protected than North America now. Unfortunately, I like to say that Asia has fallen, North America is falling, and Europe, I think, because of perhaps some of the older cultural family systems are more intact, it's more protected. But here we have like two generations of young males now, where their whole socialization is via multiplayer games. So essentially they game with other kids on their screens all the time, and they have the little subline chat rooms going off. If you ask them to stop gaming, they literally have nothing to do. And their brains have been 100% trained to only respond to that level of arousal in the game. They don't have any social skills because they don't know how to communicate anything except the gaming, and they don't have any friends apart from the gaming community. And they've been gaming since about the age of 9. So in terms of compromised development, you know, brain development in terms of arousal systems, brain development in terms of social systems, you know, brain development in terms of other components of emotional regulation, you know, these young men are very, very deregulated. It's a tragic situation.
So we've touched already on the supposed benefits of gaming and e-learning, you know, and just the ways that, you know, I used to read stuff about, oh, well, your reaction times are so much faster and, you know, you can assimilate this information so much faster also. But the question then was, what sort of information are we assimilating? And as for reaction times, all I could think of is, well, I wonder how many drone operators have brought their skill set from gaming into, like, so, oh, well, this is just the same as gaming. Oh, except that there's real people on the other end of it.
Well, the research here, you have to read the small print. That's all I can say, is if you go into the small print, you'll see a lot of this is debunked. The one completely and totally undisputable thing about games is they are fun. So if you want to play them for fun, please do. But if you find that you're staying home to game, that you're not going out playing ball, that you're not going out having a beer with your friends or a coffee with your colleagues or what have you, that's where you want to look into the negatives, because that is when it becomes an override. In terms of the type of learning, are there improvements in skills? Of course there are. But you hit the nail on the head again in terms of, do they translate into any functional use? One of the key ones that's always touted as positive is systematic rote movements improve. So you could become a better factory worker loading the chocolates into the box. Okay. That type of rote movement is, yes, you get much, much better at it. I'm being a bit sarcastic here. But if you look at driving, for example, of course you want rote systems memory, but you also want spontaneous skills to go up. Again, that's an example in the book, wherein if you're driving on a supremely windy road and you drive it every week, you're going to know that road beautifully. You're going to know exactly where to brake, exactly where to turn. I mean, it's going to be so smooth. That's an acquired skill. But if the car coming in the opposite direction towards you, does something odd, or there's a little bit of ice on the road, you need equally strong spontaneous skills. So there, for most things in life, there are skills and counter skills for all of the things that we need to do and do well. And in terms of a lot of the gaming, they tend to build up one of the skills at the expense of the other skills. Again, in the book, I could not resist being extremely sarcastic, to say the least, that there was an article that came out on, I think it was Call of Duty. If it wasn't Call of Duty, it was one of the equally violent games, essentially saying that the skills that you learned in these first-person violent shooting games were exactly the same that you would need to work very precise surgery tools. So they were saying, you know, again, talking about young boys, that young boys who played these games could grow up to be laparoscopic surgeons. And I just, you know, I pull my hair out. So, okay, you want your surgeon to learn their skills to save your life in a game where they acquired those skills killing people. So, you know, the ironies abound. But again, it makes really good robotic factory workers.
There was something you touched on there, and I want to move on to where adolescence then moves into or fails to move into early adulthood. But just before I move on from the education thing, can I just throw out a couple of thoughts? Again, close to my heart. I've paid a lot of attention to developments in these areas over the years. Not something that you're really stressing in the book, but I just like your thoughts on it. These aspects are, when it comes to the educational realm, this is relating to the internet now, in particular. The internet is just, it is what it is. It's out there. Good, bad, and indifferent, it's all there. It's a question of what our relationship is with it and what information we take from it, what information we put into it. One is this whole idea that's very much in the news at the minute, especially since the election of Trump, is this idea of fake news, that is to say disinformation on the internet, and then people are either losing or just not in the first place developing the ability to discern, you know, to use their own discernment, their own experience to say, what am I seeing here? What am I reading? What experience have I got to draw on here to try and make my way through this to make sense of it? That also then feeds into the idea of plagiarism, which for people involved in education is a huge thing. Because if you ask me to do an essay on something I know nothing about, or maybe even something that I've just started to do a course on, but I haven't read the books yet. Let's say for the sake of argument, ancient Greece. Okay. I can go onto thousands of websites and grab information all over the place about ancient Greece. What aspect of ancient Greece do you want me to talk about? I can drill down into it, narrow it down. And of course, it'll get to a point where it's like, okay, well, here's some what people would call facts. As much as we can say they're facts about ancient Greece, I can present them to my tutor. Okay, but how many ways can you say just what is? So you then get to the point where something that's plagiarized, regurgitated, just the words shuffled around a little bit, is kind of legitimate because, well, yeah, that is the situation. That is the understanding. That is the knowledge.
And well, here it's been regurgitated again, but it was very different from the way that I and you would have had to learn at school. So
if we go back to early television, some of the studies clearly showed that we do not process information when it's received by screen the same way we do when it's received what we call face-to-face. Now, two things are going on here. One is we just don't have the time to process because the next bit of information is coming on. And the TV advertising figured that out immediately. And advertising by television is one of the most efficacious ways of doing that, and maybe arguably now any screen, because people are just accepting at face value that this dish detergent or this toothpaste is the best because it was said on television. So two things are going on. One, that it's not being filtered, but we do not process on screens. And that research goes back to the absolute beginning of television. We become mesmerized. There's a kind of an inertia when we're absorbing the information. The other is the lack of conversational style. So, for example, if you tell me something, I don't know whether it's ancient Greece or about laundry detergent, and I kind of go, I can say, can I have more information, please? Or that wasn't clear. Or, oh, well, I heard this. All of that discourse that can either solidify the opinion that was presented to us or challenge it or even go in the opposite direction, none of that is occurring. So essentially, just as you said, you have the regurgitation of these little snippets of knowledge that are not being processed. Next one, plagiarism. I want to go back a little further in terms of how, you know, what were the traditional ways educationally that we got information? I might get my years wrong, but this would be in the mid-90s, when the good old World Wide Web all of a sudden had things online. And before that, all of us, we would have to go to the library. And typically, if you were in a university library or an equivalent, for the information to make it into the library, it was vetted. Okay. Now, we weren't dealing with true and untrue or checked or unchecked. We were dealing with differences of opinion. So, you know, whether we wanted to describe something as green or aqua or blue, okay, or even politics, it wasn't correct, incorrect, vetted, unvetted. It was different philosophies and different perspectives. So, when somebody was writing a paper integrating knowledge, again, they had to process the information. When we were able to get this information online, people were acting as if the information was coming from sources where it had been previously vetted. So a lot of things that had no truth whatsoever, were being treated or absorbed in the same manner that things that were vetted were. So the whole concept of the peer-reviewed journal, if we get into other components. I'm dancing around here as well. If we talk about fake news, one of the things that I've noticed that drives me crazy in terms of research is nobody's reading the statistics. Nobody's reading the news itself or the journal itself. It's PR agencies that are giving out information, and then it's just reprinted. So it's, yes, it's the medium, but something has happened in terms of whether we call it our intellectualism or our desire for the truth, that people are just repeating things without checking sources anymore. So it's a perfect scenario for everything that we're experiencing, that people are just, it's the perfect storm for whether we call it the fake news, or the absence of facts, that repetition because people aren't discussing things, they're not digesting things, they're not challenging things. You've probably noticed, especially in the U.S., the conversational style has changed. People aren't, essentially challenging things. They find they can't challenge things. There's a bullying style that's happening if somebody disagrees with somebody's opinion as opposed to an objective challenging. Again, we could go on and on about this. My big concern isn't so much about plagiarism as it is in terms of how we vet information and how we discuss the validity or the veracity of information before we repeat it and circulate it. Now, I think we've been talking really, really negatively, so maybe we should throw in some positive. When events are true, and there are things that we should take action to, again, some of the social political, action that we've been seeing over the past few years, screens and screen-based devices and the internet at large have, just really, really given people opportunity to unite and act on things in a way that was never possible 15 years ago as well. So we can't forget the positive as well.
No, yeah, of course you're right. And it's good to come back to that from time to time. And I think if for anybody who's really concerned about these topics, anything that is said that's just self-evidently overtly negative, within that there is a key or, a signpost to how it could be different, better, however it is. So that's all in there as well. That's contained within the observation that there's a problem. Just to pick up then what I said a few minutes ago, I wanted to go to where adolescence moves into or fails to move into early adulthood. You have this expression in the book Failure to Launch, and you can talk about this in just a second. I think one of the things that really got me in recent times beyond the observations in my own country and my own society around me of this phenomenon was reading about, the term escapes me now, but the articles I read, it was predominantly concerning young Japanese males, mostly males, who were ending up still living at home with their parents well into their 20s and sometimes beyond that, cocooned in their own rooms, surrounded by this technological paraphernalia, exhibiting all of the dysfunction that we've described up to this point and more, with not only no apparent way out of this, but almost no possible way out of it in conventional terms, because of the not what they'd have to unlearn, but what just that they just cannot learn. And you do have to, it really concern me, like, what is the, at what point would this get turned around for some of these young men? 2 years from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, there was nothing that I could see in the trajectory of their lives that would suggest that this could be recovered from. And I started to think, okay, what does that mean actually for wider society?
Starting with Japan, Japan's love affair with technology that's been going on, since the Second World War, essentially backfired. Internet addiction is what we used to call it. There's so many names now, but I think people understand the term regardless. But it was declared a national health issue in Korea and China because of this profile that you talked about in Japan. And this was in 2008 or 2009. So this has been going on a while. And for a country to declare this a national health issue, that gives you an idea of the volume. We also now have a major issue with this in Canada and in the U.S. Again, my travels throughout Europe are seeing you're still okay, but be careful. The profile of this is essentially the young male in some kind of a family system that's embracing the technology, that only sees this as positive, and there's some kind of an enabling behavior. So if you see that your child is eating too much candy and becoming obese, well, you take the candy away and, you don't give allowance and, what have you. You help the child to regulate their intake. And I think food is a really, really good example, because if we're talking about addiction, let's just say cocaine and heroin, okay, you take away the access and the finances for the drug, and on you go. So it's essentially a complete cessation pattern. When we're talking about technologies, it's the same as food. We're living in the modern era. you can't just stop the ingestion. You have to learn to moderate it. And with any child that's having difficulty moderating, I'm going to be very, very severe. They need really strong parents and not having the enabling feature. The other component, which may or may not be valid depending on the family and the geographical location, is, you know, we can be hoodwinked as educators and parents, in that if, I don't know, so-and-so goes up to the room and says they're doing their homework for 4 hours, well, yeah, their homework is online, and they hand it in to the teacher online. But what are they really doing there? Okay, are they, you know, doing what a lot of modern teenagers do, which they kind of do their homework online together, but they're also yip-yapping, whether it's Skype or Messenger. You know, they have all these windows open. So something that would take 20 minutes does take 4 hours, but they're having fun. Okay, is that a negative behavior? Is it a neutral behavior? Is it positive behavior? You know, jury's out. All arguments are valid. But if they're you know, pretending to do homework and all they're doing is gaming, the other one is probably time to put on the table is pornography. If all they're doing is watching pornography, well, obviously these are going to have negative consequences. And when we talk about the complete failure to launch, it is almost typically young males, and it almost always involves excessive use of gaming and excessive use of pornography. I'm going to take some chances talking about sexuality here, but
no, please do actually, because okay. This is very, very important. I've got a whole section here, headline sexuality, because this has profound effects on young people, people of all ages, including children.
Okay. Well, I'll jump right in. Okay. If you're a young male, and I'm not going to be gender biased, or for that matter, a young female who likes to watch a little bit of porn and masturbate here and there to the images, you know, go for it. That's part of modern sexuality as well. If you're an individual who essentially uses pornography consistently, and this essentially comprises your sexual life to the point that you are not interested in pursuing the opposite gender, or that when you are with the opposite gender, your systems don't function. So we're talking about erectile dysfunction in young males. Very, very common now, unfortunately, that the type of exposure, the type of pornography that anybody can get at a click of a button, real life just doesn't compare. So if you ask older individuals about their first sexual experiences, I guess before the great liberation of pornography, which it was again 2008, before that you had to pay for it, but around the year 2008, 2009, all of a sudden it was free. Before the great proliferation of pornography, people's first sexual experiences were interpersonal. I mean, essentially face-to-face, body-to-body, and also incredibly awkward. You know, it was a time where people learned how to share their bodies. Some learned how to share their hearts. They learned how to touch each other, how to give pleasure, how to receive pleasure. All of these dynamics were negotiated, and people were essentially, or majority of people were, equal learning partners. What's happening now is typically young men are learning everything online. They're not learning through interpersonal experience. They're not learning from their older brothers or their uncles, their fathers, or heck, even their mothers. They're learning everything online. And they're also learning how, I'm going to be very conservative. I'm just going to talk about males and females for now in heterosexual relationships, not to dismiss all the other forms of sexuality, but I think the example here is an important one. But young males are learning how females should react in their world from porn. So essentially, it's mimicking behavior of porn. And if young females don't react the way the women on their screens react, then the young males, they're not so much curious as to, okay, what am I doing wrong, or what do I have to learn? There's something wrong with the female, because because all of their images have shown them what sexuality should be. And again, it's an acting model. And I think we do a disservice if we, I think the amateurs posting themselves in sexual activities online, it's kind of in the same category as the professional porn. Now it's all about exhibitionism. But bottom line is people are learning from porn. The young females also know this, so they're mimicking a lot of the behaviors of the individuals in pornography as well. So the whole notion of sexuality, the stakes in the game are so much higher now. Guide me where you want to go here, but the largest concern I have now is for pre-adolescent males. So when sexual curiosity first starts to bloom, when these young males discover pornography and essentially learn how to satisfy themselves through masturbation and the consumption of images, there are regions of the brain associated with sexual desire and the pursuit of a live human being that are not developing. And when they are in physical contact with another human being, they cannot achieve or maintain an erection.
Well, I'm not too embarrassed here to admit that we used to have a joke back in the 1980s, you know, when I fell into that category of male that you're describing. It was kind of talking about sort of your first time with a girl and being surprised that she didn't have a staple in her stomach. The joke being about the centerfold, you know, in the adult magazine.
Yeah. Magnified twice, 25 billion now, yeah.
Well, this is it. But the flip side of that was, it was always accepted that if you had what we jokingly referred to as a top shelf magazine, that was a pale imitation of, to use conventional heterosexuality as we're discussing here, that was a pale imitation of being with a girl. Or, you know, whereas what we're talking about is something that whole thing's kind of got turned on its head.
The other thing is, you know, if we look at, well, you'd call them top shelf magazines, that, there were limitations to what you could get, who would get it for you, what age you had to be. There were different classifications of, you know, just soft, fuzzy pictures, you know, versus hardcore. And now with the click of a button or a mouse, you can get everything. So arousal templates are changed. You know, we see what we used to call soft porn images on bus stops now. So what it takes for people not only to be aroused, but just plain interested has massively changed.
It's just one of the key aspects of human relations, isn't it? A lot of people boil human relations down to sexuality and, you know, the procreation of the species. But given the number of people who end up in psychotherapy for issues relating to intimacy, and then how this has been aggravated by what we're seeing now, it's one thing to think about past and the history of this and how people, for various reasons, various psychological reasons, sometimes physical reasons, sometimes a combination of the two, seek help with this area of their lives. But if you're talking about not a whole generation, but, you know, sway as millions of young people growing up just steeped in this, it's just one aspect of this failure to launch thing. And it really concerns me about, and I don't think I'm exaggerating here, it does concern me about actually the future of the entire species. Not that we won't necessarily be here, but just how will this profoundly change things? To what extent will some of this thinking, the behavior, become normalized so that anecdotes about your teenage years or my teenage years might become just quaint and very far from being the norm, just as, oh, well, yeah.
It's like baking apple pie.
Yeah, you know, something people used to do, but we don't do things like that anymore.
Well, as you, when you introduced the book, the long-winded title, the last line is it, and the evolution of our species. It really, really is changing things. I was speaking with a colleague the other day, and he has an adolescent daughter, and, you know, she had some friends over, both genders, and they're all down in the basement. And, he just, as a good dad, went downstairs and looked, and he said, and they were all just lying on top of each other and all over the place. And he was saying, if I were a young male, he would have troubles not being aroused. But the young males are not aroused to the same degree as they used to be, and arguably the females as well. But that's a cute little aside. Back to how it's changing sexuality in terms of the continuation of the species. Japan is I'd say a frightening example. Now, before we blame this all on technology, iTech or screen-based technologies, there is a cultural milieu in which issues were blooming. But we have, they're called herbivore males. And I make jokes about, it means they don't eat meat in the sexual sense, but it's essentially young males, who grew up in their father's or grandfather's generations where females were very, very passive. And, if you pursued a female, yes, she was yours. This notion of females being able to reject or not be submissive just wasn't there. So that's kind of the cultural thing that many young men are losing their desire of pursuit. So essentially they're so emotionally fragile that they cannot take the rejection or the lack of interest in females. Conversely, females, they're rejecting the roles of their mothers and grandmothers. They want more equal gender relationships, whether it's at work or in the home. So they're more forceful in terms of what they demand from their mates. But the effect is there's a whole classification now of young Japanese men called herbivores, that they essentially go out with their male friends seek prostitution services, and then they go out with friends of both genders, but there's no sexuality that is consensual and romantic. It's essentially prostitution services are taking over. And that's very, very frightening. Japan, I believe, has the lowest birth rate, very low marriage rate. There are actually government programs and government incentives for marriage and for the production of children. So it's kind of interesting where we're going. The other aspect is that this whole new, or I shouldn't say new, but new to many, business of what we call sexnology. These are technologies for sexual pleasure, and again, all connected through screens. So devices that are attached to genitalia and the like for certain forms of masturbatory practice through screens. And it's a growing industry. It's a huge industry in Asia and coming over. But something is really, really up in terms of I'd say mass liberation of sexuality. And I'm not sure that it's all that great. I used to consider myself very, very open-minded in terms of sexuality, especially as a practicing therapist. Anything that two consenting adults, or if people are into multiples that consenting adults agree to, and there's no harm or no undesired embarrassment or what have you, and anything within legal age of consent and et cetera. I used to say, if you consent, whatever goes. But I'm getting more and more conservative because I feel a lot of people are suffering. Continuing with the failure to launch theme, it tends to be exclusively male. There are females that are essentially just burying themselves in their screens and their technologies. But both are under or unemployed, and with reduced scholastic load or not attending school at all, living in their parents' basements, or in their parents' homes, financially supported, by parents, family, or social services. So essentially they're not a functional participants in society. But I think one of the key problems here is, they're not perceived as harmful either. So that's why it's not on our radar. But again, speaking of Canada, if you look at, you know, for years and years, we've been, moving towards equality of the genders, whether it's in employment or social status or what have you. And we were all very, very happy when, you know, grad school, there were more and more females. But what we're noticing now, and again, I do not have the correct statistics, but majority of grad schools now are female dominant. So it's been a tipping. And this seems really positive on the one side, but it actually is rather negative. Young males are pulling out. They're not playing the game anymore. Pun intended, they're staying home and gaming. And they're using all their free time, to game, time that would have been dedicated to things like dating, working, going to school, is now dedicated to gaming. Specific to Canada, same thing. We were overjoyed in the last Olympics at all the females that were hitting the podium. And I think we were so busy celebrating all the females that were at the podium that we didn't look at why there was a dearth of males. And I think it's, again, that males are just not participating. Males are at higher risk for failure to launch. And I think we have a generation of lost boys. Simple as that.
Well, yeah, one thing that I've noticed coming up in articles and commentary about this situation is I guess I could sum it up as a comment coming from a typical young male in this category as, well, you know, there's more to life than girls, or, you know, there's so much to do, or I don't have time for that, or, you know, girls are boring, or the sort of thing that you would have heard when I was a young boy, as feigned disinterest in the opposite sex, where actually you couldn't be more interested, but you're kind of pretending to be a bit sort of, yeah, whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the opposite side of that in the modern era is with some young women or, you know, adolescent girls, whatever, just the general spectrum there is, again, kind of paraphrasing a distillation of, you know, media comment that I've read. It's kind of like, you know, where are the men? Or mm-hmm. even where are the boys? It's like, you know, what's going on? You know, I'm out with my girlfriends and it'd be great to meet a bunch of nice, interesting, you know, attractive young guys and, you know, have a great night and have some laughs and some drinks or whatever. And it's kind of like, well, where are they? You know?
Yeah, they're home gaming. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's some people are asexual. That's fine. You know, some people, it's not the phase in their life that they're interested in pursuing relationships, heterosexual or otherwise. You know, what we used to call the geek generation, you know, or nice guys finish last, or, you know, they're just different stages and phases when we have interest. But this is something that's very, very different. And there is a retreat of males, into, you know, prostitution, friends with benefits, less and less interest in emotional, sexual relationships. Again, being satisfied by pornography and to a certain extent prostitution now as well. And the, again, years, I'm going to say around 10 years ago, but I'm going to also say I could be wrong on the exact year. But again, in North America, we blamed it all on the music industry, wherein, you know, young females, the clothing became extremely tight. And, you know, the décolleté line, was getting lower and lower. So, you know, the top part of the breasts were exposed. The jeans came down very, very low, to where you could essentially see the pubic ridge. And, you know, the thong out of the back of the pants. And again, I think we very erroneously blame this all on the hip hop industry and the music industry. And it was much more than that. That was about the time that porn became completely free, and females were dressing this way because they were not getting the attention of males otherwise. And there's been a major, major switch now. You know, who knows, evolution, conservative, right, wrong, what have you. But males are no longer, in many, many cultures, the pursuers. Females are. And that is because there is less and less of an interest of males in the pursuit. And I don't mind sharing my age at all. I'm in my late 40s now. But my generation in North America is the last generation that knows the pursuit of the male.
Yeah. So and that what you just said is kind of really that puts it in focus, because it's not like there's, you know, a generation from the point of view that we're talking about isn't every 25 years. It's kind of like every 10 years. I often think in terms of culture that every generation is 10 years. That might even be contracting now. I'm not sure.
I think it's changing much faster with the technology now. In terms of our worldviews and how we interact with each other and the technology, it's much, much faster. So again, there's that whole debate, what do we call a generation? Is it a generation of birthing, meaning of reproduction, or is it a generation based on society and culture?
A generation of iPhones.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, so 6 months, there you go.
Well, isn't it interesting that they talk about the new generation of iPhones, you know, will be released shortly? Well, I spend a lot of time looking at technology, the benefits and disbenefits to society and the development of it. And a couple of things here really pertaining, very relevant to what we're talking about. One is that we're seeing a lot of technology that's actually inferior to previous incarnations. Mm-hmm. In terms of, you know, for people like you and I of our generation, we're looking, okay, what's the practical benefit here? What does it do? How good is it at its job? What does it cost? And what have you. And we do have generations now who are getting the latest iPhone or whatever it happens to be because it's the latest, not because it's better. And it's been pitched as better. And we're seeing these sort of diminishing returns. So that's one thing. Another is, and this is a question which is not beyond the scope of your book, but you're not addressing it. And I'm not expecting you to launch off into a screed here on this, but it's something I get into here very often with guests, and that's the future of technological society. So you don't have to agree with this proposition, but maybe just consider it. I think in the coming decades, possibly in our lifetimes, we're going to see some major difficulties for the technological infrastructure globally that supports all of this gubbins that we're talking about. And it may result in a lot of people being forced into the aforementioned cold turkey. I'm not sure that technological progress is a one-way street, put it that way. I don't think that we're going to see just off into the, foreseeable future, just ever more technology, ever more shiny gadgets at ever cheaper prices for everyone. I think we're going to hit a wall at some point, and it could be a very nasty wake-up call for people who know nothing else.
Yes, I'm glad you went there. Not in my book at all, but if you look at a lot of the medical literature in terms of EMF fields, and how the increase in brain tumors, electromagnetic illness, or electromagnetic sensitivities, if many people that are living too close to specific cell towers and the like are reporting a lot of lack of wellness in the absence of a better term. Just the arousal levels being exposed to a lot of the technology. We didn't even talk at all about my work, but I work in a applied branch of psychology where we're constantly looking at brainwaves. I have essentially discovered a change in brainwaves that's associated with overexposure to screens. So it's black and white, and it's changing our brainwaves. And I'm not the only one on this now. There's this whole emergent field. And I think we'd be very, very wise to look at this and to ensure that the technology is safe and stays safe. And part of that might be using it more as a tool as opposed to the constant that we always have. That said, there's a real pushback as well. And a joke I like to make is, you know, there's a lot of really strong research out there that we have to be careful. But all you need is one person, you know, running around with a colander on their head you know, with a bunch of tinfoil. And it makes anybody that's researching this equally crazy. So the good news is you have a lot of very qualified people looking at this now. And it will be interesting. And a lot of us are choosing, you know, to not be available on email or our phones after certain hours of night. And I think making very, very wise choices in terms of the role they want technology to have in their lives.
No, and it's true. There is a whole dimension of your work, which you talk about in the book that we didn't get into, because, you know, we've been talking here for quite a long time, but it is ultimately limited. We're not pretending to cover all the bases here. So I would just urge people, as we begin to wind things up for today, you know, to get the book, explore that, check out, you know, your resources online and all the related work. There's a lot going on here, because what you have spoken about is physical and potentially irreversible changes to the human brain. And that's, I mean, who knows where that could take us? I mean, there's a lot of speculation there. But as you say, work is ongoing. The upcoming millennia are going to change us as a species, you know, but in what ways? Are they going to be natural? Are we going to be self-induced, self-inflicted? It's fascinating, but scary as well, you know.
Well, we're already there in so many ways. Again, I could chew your ear off in terms of how we've been altering. You know, we've been interfering with evolution for, you know, the longest time. It just happens to be a technological interference now. And, you know, many people kind of say, hey, what you worried about? You know, yeah, of course, evolution of the species, you know, and then, you know, the counter is, well, hey, we don't want to become Borg either, you know, and somewhere, you know, the truth is always in the middle. And I'd say with any new, massive shift, in technology that affects evolution to, the degree it is now, keep your eyes open. And, you know, do your due diligence, do the research, and keep talking.
Well, just to end on a positive note, really, you know, what we're not doing when we're online is very important. And in some cases, maybe even more important than what we're doing online. There's a world out there of experience that hasn't just gone away, hasn't just become old hat or useless or tired or redundant because of new technology. Technology was meant to enhance some of it, be an adjunct to it, be an alternative in some cases, and an improvement, but it wasn't meant to be a total replacement. Just leave us with, I don't know, a positive reflection, any flavor whatsoever, any dimension that you would care to.
Well, I'm going to keep it very, very simple. It's integration versus interference. Integration is absolutely fantastic, and that it's a complement, not an override. And we have been talking a lot about the fears and the negative and the scientific proof of the negative. But there's so much positive out there. And you know, the whole notion of distance, is obliterated by screen-based technologies, which is fantastic. Swinging back to, education, one of the best platforms to teach basic mathematics is on screens, you know. So we just have to pick and choose in terms of, you know, and stay very, very open-eyed in terms of the extreme positives and the extreme negatives. But I guess in terms of closing, I would say balance, balance, balance. Just ensure that your use of the technologies and the screens is balanced with all of the other beauties that life has to offer.
Okay, well, Mary, we've been discussing your book entitled iMinds, How Cell Phones, Computers, Gaming, and Social Media Are Changing Our Brains, Our Behaviour, and the Evolution of Our Species. That's available everywhere. Perhaps you'd just care to share your website or websites and just any other resources or anything else you'd like to put out there.
Okay. Well, I do have a limited website. It's drmariswingle.com. You can learn a little bit more about my work there and articles and presentations and the like. There's contact information there as well. The book is also out in an audiobook for the generation that doesn't like to read so much. There's a little tease there. Or for those of us who commute, we like to listen in our cars or what have you. So that would be where you can find more info.
Well, Mary, thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.